Hi, I'm Jesse Driscoll. I'm here with Christian Davenport, and we're bringing you the Raiders of the Lost Archive. Archives are repositories of special information. Archives can take many forms, historical documents, oral histories, or data sets that can't just be downloaded. We're asking questions to allow some special guests to speak candidly about their research process. The conversations will be archived here for the social science community. Thanks for listening.
So, Bob, we usually like to have our guests introduce themselves so that we're doing this properly. How would you introduce yourself?
Well, my name, as you know, is Robert Bates, and I'm retired now from the professoriate. I started out 45 years ago at Caltech, and then went to chaired position at Duke University, where my wife was an alum, and she was also in academic administration. They took us as a pair, and then when I got an offer from Harvard, we came back home to New England, and so I've been at Harvard for over 15 years. So.
I think this is far better than ever actually introducing someone to have them do it themselves. Okay, so we're gonna jump right in, Bob. What is the topic or question you were interested in examining for the research project that you went into the field to collect data on?
This was the beginning of my interest in political violence. I had worked in Zambia. I work in Africa overwhelmingly. And I worked in Zambia in the mine townships. And there was a group in the mine townships that were called the Ginger Group. And they were violent. They were the guys who started riots and beating up people, especially around election time. And I wanted to understand where these guys were coming from, why they were behaving this way. So they were all from Luapula province, which is a province in the northeast of Zambia. And so I got funded and went up there. And I moved into a village called Kasumpa Village, where I rented a little house, shack, really, and then got a better understanding of what they were doing and realized that violence was one of the series of choices they were making to divert resources from the center to the periphery, to the rural periphery. And so then I dug deeper, but that's the way it got going. That's what motivated it and got me in the field and got me doing research.
Why Zambia? Why
Zambia? Because I'd worked there before. I'd worked in the mining townships before. And so I knew my way around. The startup time when you're hitting a new country and a new, basically a new political system can be very, it's a big barrier. You have to learn.
No, of course, but wind it back a second. I mean, you say you'd been there before.
Yeah, I'd been to Zambia. Sorry, I missed your
What took you
question.
There originally?
Again,
what
research.
Took you to Zambia originally?
Research. It was research into the mine workers union. Zambia is one of the largest, contains a series of copper mines, and a very significant producer of various minerals, cobalt and copper. In the mine townships, I decided that's where I wanted to start my career. And I wrote a book on it, the Mine Workers Union, Mine Workers in Zambia. And then that's where I ran into these, I'd call them specialists in violence, these people from Luapula. And I wanted to see what made them tick. So it was just curiosity.
Okay, hold it, Bob. I think where Jesse is going is you're born in America, yes?
Yep.
And then you find your way in Zambia. We're just trying to figure out how the first Zambian experience came about.
Well, it began, I went to a prep school, Harvard School, and they decided that we were all spoiled, arrogant, and ignorant. And one of the parents financed a summer program for some kids from, as I recall, and then kids from other schools, largely public schools throughout the rest of the United States, total of about 15 of us. And financed a summer in Africa where we could learn how other people lived and what their lives were like. He happened to be Harold Schild, who was one of the owners of American Metals Climax and had two mines in Zambia. His son was Adam Hochschild, who you may have read stuff by. He's become a rather prominent writer. And he was on the trip with me. And so when I wanted to go back as a graduate student for my dissertation work and then later, going back to that place made a lot of sense. It was accessible and feasible for me to do so. That's what.
So when you were going back as a graduate student to do the research, what did people tell you before you went?
Which people are you referring to?
When you were in graduate school, any people, your advisors, colleagues who were mentoring you, classmates?
Yeah. No, they... when you work on Africa in most American graduate schools, you don't have a lot of colleagues who are mentors who are going to advise you very closely. They're basically going to listen to you and try and help you as best they can. So I really didn't have much guidance. What they wanted to know is, did I have a problem I wanted to work on? And in both cases, the first time out to Zambia, the second, I did have a fairly well-formulated problem. But other than that, they really didn't have much to offer. I was largely on my own. And so I was untutored, as you would.
Which is distinct from untutorable, which is, I think, a good distinction. But what's interesting, Bob, is what did you see as the kind of research material at the time? Were you more ethnographic in your impression at the time, or were you envisioning that you were going to go through some documents? What was your kind of corpus?
Well, the mining companies, particularly the personnel departments, was what I was interested in. I wasn't interested in the engineering or financing or production side. I was interested in labor relations and their interaction with African society. So there were a lot of documents, and they maintain spies in the mine townships, and were actually pretty good at their jobs. And I found a lot of what they were reporting was true. So I worked through that collection. And then when I came back to go to Luapula, there were government provincial and local administration documents that I had access to in the headquarters in the regional headquarters in Luapula. I also had good connections with the ruling, and they also maintained a large number of files. So I went through those, but I was basically relying on making contacts of my own and getting to see, not from the administration or the mining town or the mining company's point of view, but from the point of view of villagers or the township inhabitants and how they related to the structures about them that had the wealth and power. So it was a grassroots. I was trying to get look at it from the grassroots perspective.
How did you get access to the documents of the internal security apparatus of a mining company? I mean, if they had maintained a spy network and they just shared the files with you, how did that work?
Well, remember Harold Hochschild. You know, I knew the owner of the company.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I use so every
let me
asset.
Ask a question from the other. All right. So let me ask the question from the other side. If the locals saw you as being affiliated with the spy network, because you obviously at some level were, why did they trust you to talk to you?
Because I lived with them. This was a highly racialized society. And the fact that any white man would move into a house in the townships or in the village, and basically make it very clear that he was reliant on them, that I was frank about my agenda and what I was trying to do, and I asked for their help. And I don't think that happens very much in those kinds of settings that are that racialized. So to some degree, it was awkward because I'd be sort of shown off by them as a special person who they were working with or who I was reliant upon. Most of the time, it was a thrill, to see the world from their point of view and to see where they were coming from and what it was like to be a black person, even in Africa. A very highly racialized context in that southern part of Africa. Yeah.
So I have a kind of a methods question, basic one.
Yeah.
It seems like you have quantitative data in this initial project that comes from the company, from the government. And then you have qualitative data that comes in conversations with these more interesting subjects that are less legible statistically. Mm-hmm. How did you integrate mm-hmm. those two different types of data, two different kinds of insights, when you were an initial graduate student and you were trying to put it together for yourself?
Well, there was a third set of data, which were survey data. When I ran surveys after I'd gone through sort of living and getting a sense of... When I went into a village or into a township, I reached a point where I was no longer surprised, where then I began to realize I pretty well decoded my environment. And at that point, I'd achieved an understanding of what was driving the behaviors that were my dependent variables, which was violence or whatever, usually conflict. And then I figured out how to measure and explain the variance in that kind of behavior. So it moved from a qualitative decoding and understanding of my environment to a set of hypotheses and explanations. Choices people were making, and that became testable. And so I'd move into survey research mode. Now, I couldn't ever really do terrific survey research because I was understaffed and underfunded. But I did make sure I did enough of it that I could check my ideas out and verify them.
So, Bob, we tend to think of, or at least Jesse and I are trying to push this idea of, you might have an initial formulation of an idea of kind of like what you think's going on. And then you kind of collect some more stuff, or you go back home and you kind of reflect again. But so what do you think were your first insights, and then kind of like, where did you go with them?
How did they get modified? Well, let's stick with the rural study of this village in Luapula, Kasumpa. I went out there to see where these militants, political militants, were coming from, and who became the ginger wing of the of whatever political party they were a member of in the townships and in the city, and the people who were willing to beat up people and cause violence. When I got in the rural areas, I realized there was that in terms of what they were trying to do, there were sort of three frontiers or three lines of action that they were adopting. One was that if they wanted to increase their incomes, they could migrate to the cities. And so I studied migration and did a fair amount of pretty good survey research on that. But another alternative they could have was to cash crop and sell cash crops to the town. And in Luapula, the cash crop was fish. It's where the Luapula River goes up, and one of the Central African lakes is right there. And the mine townships, there were a lot of big consumer market for fish. And so that was the second, that was a viable alternative for them. And then the last way was through violence and protest, and making it in the government interests to throw money at them by defecting from the ruling party or defecting from the government and forming alliances with the opposition, threatening to pull the province, Luapula province, out of the governing coalition. So it became a matter of looking at the conditions under which people either chose to export to the town, to migrate to the town, or to make it in the government's interest to move the money out to the rural areas to buy their loyalty. That's the way the pieces of the puzzle got assembled after I achieved an understanding of what I was seeing.
Do you think that the dynamic of mobilizing violence in order to get noticed and get bought off was similar to the violence dynamic that you initially set out to study? Do you think it's the same thing, or do you think they're just two different things in different places?
The early stage of violence was against what was called the Central African Federation, which was where Zambia was cobbled together with Malawi and southern Rhodesia into a state. And it was run by whites. And it was a form of white supremacy. And Malawi was the first to blow up the federation, and Zambia followed very quickly thereafter. Of course, Rhodesia followed much later. So that was purely political and racial. The violence and the threat of violence after that was a tactic, and it led to violent reprisals by the government. And this tactic was to flirt with the opposition so as to bring the government down. Eventually, the government imposed a one-party state, which put an end to that use of that tactic. Thereafter, I moved on beyond Zambia at that point, so I didn't see how the rural dwellers played their card in that political setting. So I don't know if they had any cards to play at that point, except to migrate or produce fish.
So, Bob, listening to your discussion about the violence, I initially think of the mob and our conceptions of it. But I'm also wondering about this can't necessarily be an easy or safe topic necessarily to work on. So did you have any run-ins with these folks, or did you have any problems or difficulties in doing this research?
Not really, for two reasons. One is, let you know when they were going to become violent. So you would stay out of the way. They would dress up and sort of decorate themselves in ways that signaled that they were not going to behave like human beings. And that way you could get out of there, or at least avoid them. Now I'm sorry, Christian. I've lost the thread of my thought. So I don't know if I answered your question or not.
No, you did, and then you made me think of January 6th in the Capitol with people adorning. With people adorning themselves in preparation for engaging in violent behavior, but that kind of obvious signaling then answers that question. But it doesn't kind of capture the other part, which was more or less like, did you have any access problems or run-ins with people? So basically, you were able to study violence, but effectively not have any of that violence turn on you.
That's right. People went out of their way to make sure I wasn't a victim of it. Remember, I was just a single guy. I was living in a hut in a village. This is the second time I was out there in the rural areas. I had friends, and some of those friends were leaders of the violence group. They made sure I knew when, things were going to get dodgy. In the mining townships, the thing there that really sealed my security was not only did I work in the townships, but also my wife. And a white woman coming in there, and we weren't the enemy. We were a species unto ourselves, and people took care of us. You feel indebted to them.
How long did you stay with your wife?
We're still married. That's a joke. We were there, I'd say, the better part of a year in the field. Maybe an actual full yield, but it was quite a while. The second time I went out, when I went out of the rural areas, I was there for about a year. So, yeah, you find in doing that kind of qualitative field work that you dig deeper, and then you're stuck for a while, and then all of a sudden you get another level of understanding, and you're stuck for a while, and then you get even deeper, and you begin maybe I was fooling myself, but you begin to see the structures about you, the world about you, and the forces at play from the viewpoint of the people you're studying. That probably, I'm sure I could have gone even deeper, but I had to get home.
When do you decide to go home? I mean, when do you decide to stop sinking deeper and deeper? An easy answer is when the money runs out, but that doesn't seem like a complete answer for you.
Well, also remember you've got to return to a job. You've got to return to a professional advancement. Come back right up, get a job. There are pressures originating from the country you left, in addition to the enticements that are attracting you to stay in the country at home, in the country abroad. And at some point, the pressures are stronger than the inducements to stay.
That was great, Bob. How did your experience in the field influence your understanding of the research process in general and data collection in particular?
I think the ideal process of data collection that and the one I suggest to my students is you ought to think through the problem before you go out and create an instrument that allow you to collect systematic, quantifiable data to test your ideas. But consider that really an exercise to prepare your mind to investigate. And when you get out there, then just soak and poke. Follow up the ideas or the intuitions or the hypotheses that you have and interview and see if they hold true or if they require modifications for the work or whatnot. And then rewrite that instrument and collect the data as the last stage of your work. Because it'll be data that is based on a far deeper understanding than the one you brought to the field in the first place. So leave time at the end to do the survey work, but don't start there. You're not ready yet.
So give me a quick follow-up. I'm under the impression that there's part of that I think a larger number of people could do. So like people could probably administer a survey or some questions that have been done before. That the soaking and poking part, the being flexible, the expansive part, do you think that can be taught? Or do you think some people are just better built for doing that type of work?
That's a really good question. Well, to begin with, the way you approach the problem really depends on the problem. There are a lot of problems where you could run a controlled statistical investigation from the get-go. I have never encountered that, but I don't. But I expect that maybe and there maybe are there may be out there. I think the real complexity of certainly local political forces are ones that have to be lived in and experienced before you can understand that. And that would be true in Ireland. It would be true in Detroit. It would be true in Liverpool. You know, it's... You've got to enter into that world and see the role of the victims and also see the role of the predators, where they're coming from, why they're behaving that way. And they are human beings like us, but they're behaving in ways that we don't most of the time, for most of us. But we have to get our, we have to see the world through their eyes, walk in their shoes, and try and figure out what's going on.
Let me follow up on that, because I think that it's disorienting for a lot of people who are in this job or thinking about this job, because a lot of the socialization in graduate school is not with people who would say what you just said. A lot of the socialization is with people who are training them to do statistical analysis, hybridize their careers with data science. And then a lot of the referees are Americanists, right? And so I know that you had the experience of coming back from the field and re-entering and then showing up in Caltech. The write-up, you know, making your ideas accessible to the people who were evaluating your work must have been a little bit bruising, but you succeeded. And I'd like to know what that experience was like, to the extent that you learned anything from it that you could pass on to the next generation of students. I think that would be really valuable.
I think, one of the reasons I went to Caltech was I'd become very close friends with an anthropologist who works in the Gwembe province of Zambia, guy by the name of Thayer Scudder, and his colleague, who's better known, Elizabeth Coulson. And they were anthropologists, and Ted was at Caltech, and he was recruiting because they were starting a division of social sciences. He wanted to have a buddy there. He didn't want just statisticians around. He wanted people who knew the part of the world he knew and had appreciation for the kind of work he did. So that was made the adjustment to the profession gentler and easier for me than it would have been the case if I tried to do it on my own. I think the other thing I wanted to add, if I can bring the thought to mind, is that, no, it's gone off into the ether. I'm going to have to stop there so you can re-put the question if you want, if I didn't answer it. Yeah.
No, I think you answered it. You answered it great. It's hard to square the professional incentives of a quantitative field with the attention to local nuance and the kind of, you know, vapor of interactions that you acquire in the field sometimes. And
I think the main thing that should guide you is the nature of the problem you're working on. And if the problem is one that doesn't yield to interviews and field work, but rather yields to large end data collection where you can run the numbers and come up with an answer, then the choice is made for you really by the nature of the study you want to make. But you should be prepared to do both. And I don't know how you teach qualitative work. I would have liked to have done more of in trying to teach it, but I think the way that it was best taught to me was that you're a human being and you're an instrument, and you can react to the environment about you and draw insight from it as a human being and take advantage of that. You know, it's it also has the advantage of getting you off your high horse, because you realize in a lot of these situations, you're totally inexperienced. You have no sophistication, no no way to defend yourself in the environments that you're studying. You're reliant on other people.
Yes.
And so you approach it as just another figure in that environment, contested environment.
Bob, that's fantastic. Before we close, this was beautiful, but before we close, it just seems so fitting. One of my warmest remembrances of doing research in the field is running into you when we ran into each other in Rwanda.
Yes.
And Bob was there with, I think, three of his students, three of the most remarkable human beings that I had come across. And then Bob enters the room, and it just kind of like just added this amazingly kind of like fitting end to it. But your discussion of kind of leading with your humanity and using that as a way of understanding your environment and conducting the thing that we do was so embodied in that moment. As I remembered interacting with them, you kind of let them each tell me about themselves and while you were kind of there, and then inform them about some other stuff. But it was really a heartwarming moment from my perspective, because it was nice to see how someone of such prominence interacted with their students. And these were like, they, although they were undergrads, they seemed so phenomenally kind of sophisticated in many respects. But seeing your interaction with them was so informative to me as a researcher and a mentor, and just kind of learning how the craft was, seeing it embodied. While I thought many of them were naive, I still thought that they were like phenomenal people. And that engagement was so, I'm like, wow, if that's how Bob is with his students, I'm just like, okay, all right, I need to ramp it up, basically, is how I felt that from that moment. I thought it was phenomenal to see. And I don't know if I ever shared with you how I felt about that moment. And I also wrote a short story about it, which I'll post on the site, but it's Dr. Bates, I presume. I sent it to you. But I'll send it to you. It's a description of this environment and this interaction and truly how wonderful it was. But it follows directly from what you said a second ago. But I just wanted to thank you for coming today and sharing with us. That was great.
And thanks for so much.
Well,
you've given the field more than I can say.
Sorry? I'm sorry?
Thank you so much for everything you've given to the field. I'm not an Africanist, but the study of political violence has been changed by your synthesis of the rational choice approach and the qualitative stuff that you clearly value so much. I speak for a lot of people.
Thank you.
When I say that. No, thank you.
Well, I deeply appreciate it. Thank you for sharing that. Do you remember who those students were that I was in Rwanda with?
I remember. I remember one kid had like this crazy kind of bright red hair, and it was set against. I think he's like wearing a white T-shirt, but it was like a very kind of explosive red hair, kind of humanitarian oriented. I think he had run an NGO or something like that. Yeah, they were all going to go interact with like the Gachacha process, and I'm just like, yeah, you might not want to do that. But they were also earnest. I didn't feel like I really wanted to go at them. And then Bob was kind of like, he was kind of like listening to it all, but I was kind of like, yeah, I think I'll roll that back. And then we let them go. But as they discuss, I wish I was as faithful and as earnest as they were at that moment. I'm like, wow, I miss those days. It was really great.
Hello. Thank you for listening to Raiders of the Lost Archive. For writings mentioned in this podcast, as well as what we're going to be doing in the future, please feel free to look at archiveraiders.weebly.com.